From the defense of the faith to the education system of our nation to hope for revival, all coming your way today, right here.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Friends, it is great to be with you today on The Line of Fire. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, spiritual, and cultural revolution. I just saw posted on Twitter a moment ago, Rhonda, you're a voice of reason in a chaotic world. And someone posted, posted on our Facebook page, Laura, the other day, you are my news station. I don't trust anyone else. So thank you for keeping me updated on what's going on with a godly and true viewpoint. I deeply appreciate all the work you are doing. Hey, friends, that warms my heart because that's why we are here. That's why we are on the air. This is not my thing. This is not my vision. I've got some ambition to be on the radio or to take your time. No, I'm here to serve you as best as I can and to be a defender of the truth and to speak the truth in love. If that challenges you, if that encourages you, whatever, the goal is to speak the truth in love. And I so appreciate you taking your time out of your busy day to listen to the broadcast. We've got some special guests in this first hour. J. Warner Wallace, well-known Christian apologist. We're going to be talking about the defense of the faith in an upcoming major conference taking place in Charlotte, North Carolina in just a few months. And then be speaking with journalist Peter LaBarbera about some disturbing things in our national education system and the question of why take on the culture. So we've got a couple of special guests coming your way. I've got to tell you something funny, though, that happened yesterday. So we released the trailer for my new book, Saving a Sick America. And if you haven't watched the trailer yet, it's just 3 minutes long. It's on our YouTube channel, Ask Dr. Brown on YouTube. Trust me, it's an eye-opener. People have been writing to me and saying, wow, very powerful, very compelling, well done. I read some excerpts from the introduction to Saving a Sick America as I fall asleep. I'm a dad who falls asleep watching Leave It to Beaver with his family in 1961 and wakes up and it's today. Oh, yeah. So that's on the trailer and it's graphically, powerfully illustrated. And the whole purpose of the book, though, is to give us a prescription for moral and cultural reformation, a gospel-based, Bible-based plan of attack. Okay, here are the problems. Here's God's solution. Here's how we live this out and make a difference. So one of the folks who endorsed the book is Sean McDowell and gave a very gracious endorsement. Sean's a professor of apologetics and, of course, Josh McDowell's son. He said, Saving a Sick America is a modern-day wake-up call for the church. Dr. Michael Brown rightly recognizes that we live in dire times, and yet he offers a hopeful prescription for how the church can seize this moment for good. This book is insightful, convicting, yet inspiring. My hat is off to Dr. Brown for having the courage to write this book. Well, somebody comes on our YouTube channel. This got stopped before it got posted, actually, but or taken away shortly after it was posted. And I sent a note to Sean accordingly. But it's a guy using the name Sean McDowell, right? So fake identity with Sean's picture. And this is what he posted. This will be another useless book from a man who is targeting the wallets of a small, gullible group of people. Shame on you, Michael Brown. So I sent it to Sean and let him know about it. But that's par for the course. Welcome to my world. If you want to order a signed, numbered copy from the first printing, and we'll get it to you before the release date in late September, just go to my website, AskDrBrown.org. You can order there. We'll be right back with apologist J. Warner Wallace.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
From homicide detective to Christian apologist, that is the story of my guest, J. Warner Wallace. Many of you know him as the cold case apologist, author of books like Cold Case Christianity and God's Crime Scene. J. Warner Wallace was a conscientious and vocal atheist through his undergraduate and graduate work in design and architecture. He's always considered himself to be an evidentialist, so his experience in law enforcement only served to strengthen his conviction that truth is tied directly to evidence. And at the age of 35, he took a serious look at the Christian worldview, the Christian faith, became a follower of Jesus in 1996, and now is using his skills as a homicide detective to bring the gospel to this generation. Jim, great to have you back with us on The Line of Fire.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm really looking forward to it all week.
Oh, well, thank you, sir. Hey, one thing that you've done that's really fascinating is try to take your way of doing apologetics and bring it down to the level that young people can grasp it as well. How have you gone about doing that, and what kind of results are you seeing?
Well, I think the first way to do it is just to, I'm just committed to young people. I think what my background was shaped by my experience. You know, when my kids were growing up, they were younger. I was a brand new Christian, so I started serving in children's ministry, and then I followed with them all the way through their elementary school years and into the youth years, and I was a high school pastor for a number of years. And so as I kind of got, I just fell in love with this generation that really is the one that I think is under the most challenge right now. If you look at the statistics, you know, regardless of how we interpret them, it's young people do not fare as well as older people. And when they hold certain views, theological views, they're far more likely to be heretical than older Christians. So I think this is the generation we need to reach. And for me, it's just a matter of transferring passion, right? I mean, I think if young people see that you truly are passionate about helping them, or interested in them as your focus group. I mean, this is, I would put down all of my speaking agenda to reach young people, and most of my speaking calendar is with young people. I mean, that's part of it. I think they catch that passion. But then what you're also trying to do is to make the concepts accessible, right? We're all translators. We're kind of resting on the shoulders of the great thinkers. I do this all the time in my criminal cases. I'll bring in expert witnesses who are very qualified as scientists and other forms of expert testimony. But in the end, we have to be able to communicate that to a jury in a way. We've got to throw the ball in a way they can catch it. So we're going to use that. We're going to stand on their shoulders, but we're going to be a conscientious translators of all that material.
And what effect do you see? You're doing conferences with Frank Turek and others. You're speaking to college age and probably even younger kids. There's so much confusion these days with the digital media, the soundbiting of everything. Often it's hard to even get people to think and listen. Are you able, with your background, to engage them, and are you seeing fruit?
I think we are, but it's probably not as much by my giftedness as it is by just the way that God has shaped my background, right? If you're going to come in and say, hey, I'm going to make the case for the reliability of Scripture as an historian or as a literary expert, well, that's one way to do it, and certainly I am standing on the shoulders of those experts. But when I want to come in, I'm going to say, I'm going to throw this to you in a way that you've been watching on TV for years. If you've watched Dateline or you've watched any crime show, you know how to work a crime scene. You know how to investigate eyewitnesses. You've seen detectives do that. Well, what if we just took that skill set and we leaned it and applied it to the gospel authors, or we applied it to the crime scene that I would call the universe? Okay, so if we were to do that, I think we end up speaking a language that young people are already familiar with. And I think you're right about one thing. They're digital natives, right? This Gen Z, you and I would say we're digital immigrants. You know, we came to it from a world that wasn't digital. But these folks have always lived in the digital world. And I think you're right about attention span. But it's not that they don't have the ability to think for 3 hours. They'll watch a three-hour movie, no problem. But in that three-hour movie, there'll be 6,000 scene changes. So I think what we've done is we've raised a generation that has got a short attention span visually. So I've tried to make my presentations visual. My undergraduate degree is in design. My master's degree was in architecture before I became a police officer. So for me, everything has been visual. All my cases in front of juries have been entirely visual. So I know that how I'm going to reach this generation is to kind of speak the language that they already speak because they're, you know, holding that glowing rectangle at the end of their arm, and they want it to be visual. Make it visual. Help me to see it. And I think if we can do that for young people, we'll get their attention and we'll hold their attention.
Yeah, and it is unique gifting. In fact, it's a bit of an unusual journey from design and architecture to police force, isn't it?
Yeah, I never thought that those two. I kind of thought I'd wasted my youth, right? I was a cop at 27 or 28, and I was thinking, okay, that was good, but I'll never go back to that. I won't be drawing diagrams anymore. And then it turns out, as I became a youth pastor, all of that artistic background came up again because I was trying to teach difficult theological or apologetics concepts, and I knew I needed to make them visual. So here I was back again creating visual arts to reach another generation, and I thought, well, this transfers pretty well. We started doing it in our criminal cases in front of juries. So I think we actually pushed the envelope about as far as I could push it with juries in terms of what can we do visually to make a case. And I've just taken that with me now as I take the stage to do this kind of work with young people.
Friends, my guest, Jay Warner Wallace, perhaps you've read his famous book, Cold Case Christianity. You may not know he also has Cold Case Christianity for Kids, other books, Forensic Faith, God's Crime Scene, Looking at the Universe. Jim, when you're speaking to younger people, what would you say are some of the biggest obstacles that they're hitting now in terms of their own faith?
Well, you know that maybe when I was, I don't know how old you are, Michael, but I'm 56. So if I go back and look at my life growing up, I was not a Christian until I was 35. But as a young man, the thing that I think was the wedge issue, probably for most Christians, was this idea that science and evolution would eventually explain everything and that there was no need for this crazy creation story we see in Genesis. But I don't think that is the wedge issue anymore for this generation. The wedge issue for this generation is sex. And let's just be honest. It's sexuality, it's gender identity, it's marriage. All the moral revolution that we have undergone as a culture in the last generation has been absolutely purchased by the Gen Z group. In other words, if you were to poll them, the Christians, who are in that age range, you know, of high school, and ask them what they believed about the critical social issues related to marriage and gender, you'll see that for the most part, they have already purchased, they've already bought in to the cultural views on all of these definitions. In other words, they're not coming at it from a Christian perspective and struggling with it. They're wondering why their adult Christian parents don't get it. Like, what's the deal? They've already accepted the worldview teaching on those issues of the culture. And that's where I think we've got that's the wedge issue right now. At some point, it sounds to young people like, you want me to join your club, but in order to join your club, I've got to become a racist. Well, I'm sorry, being a racist is wrong, therefore I'm not joining your club. Well, it's kind of like saying now, you want me to join your club, but you want me to accept these and reject these the moral behavior of people I like, who I know, who are either artists I'm listening to or people I'm going to school with, the entire transgender community, the homosexual community, and they're saying, hey, I can't do that to join your group any more than I could be a racist to join your group. They see these two things as almost parallel ideas.
Right. So they know that God is loving and kind, and that God accepts people as they are, and that we should be nice. I mean, this is their gospel, basically. So what you're telling them is that you should be mean to Jimmy, who identifies as Jane, and you should be mean to Sue and Sally, who are really nice and love each other. That's what they're hearing, basically.
Yeah, I mean, the part of it is we've got to help our young people see this not just as the key to happiness, but as the cure for what's killing us. Mm. And there are times when, you know, nobody would take chemotherapy by choice when they've come down with cancer. Nobody wants to go through the side of nobody. But if you've got cancer and this is the only cure, you're willing to say, okay, this is it. And by the way, if your parents were trying to give you that cure of chemotherapy, they would be doing it out of a position of love. You would actually see their efforts to pay for your chemotherapy, for example, as an expression of love. What we've lost, I think, is the ability to communicate the gospel as an objective reality about the cure for what's killing all of us spiritually. And also, we've got to redefine what love. The culture I think we're living in has redefined love as the kind of simple, you know, kind of gushing platitudes that we don't think about love as tough love. that a loving God, if he is loving, would also have you have to have justice. If you're not equally just, your love is nothing but an expression. Of course, if you're all justice and no love, you're just a tyrant. So it's holding those two things in balance, truth and mercy, grace and justice. That's what makes God loving. So it's don't be surprised then if your loving Father, Heavenly Father, loves you, but also has a view that he wants you to hold, which is a truth view, a justice view. So I think this is what we have to kind of communicate to our kids. It's not just most Frank and I say this all the time at our conferences, right, Frank Turk and I, that most people are not on a truth quest. They're on a happy quest.
Yeah, friends, we're going to take that up on the other side of the break. I want to find out what J. Warner Wallace will be talking about at the SES Apologetics Conference in October. I'll be speaking there as well. The lineup looks terrific. We'll be right back.
Fire we want, for fire we please.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to The Line of Fire. I'm speaking with J. Warner Wallace, author of Cold Case Christianity and other important apologetics books. Jim, at the Southern Evangelical Seminary Apologetics Conference in October, you'll be speaking, I'll be speaking as well. What are your topics there?
Well, it's a great conference. As you know, it's probably the biggest conference in the country on October 12th and 13th, or 13th and 14th, actually, the Friday and the Saturday. We have a pre-conference also on the 12th. But anyway, the point is, it's at Calvary Church in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I'll be speaking about, well, usually I'll do a talk at least on the resurrection or on the case for the reliability of Scripture, but this year I'm going to close the conference with really just a call for encouragement. There are four attributes of first responders that help us to be in the world but not of the world. And I think if we as Christians adopted these four attributes, we would be more effective in the world while still remaining our position as not being of the world. So that'll be my talk on the last session on Saturday.
Yeah, excellent. I was just looking at some of the schedule there, and I see that there's going to be a debate between Professor Richard Howe and Dan Barker, who leads an atheist association. Dan Barker, a former minister, now an outspoken atheist. They're going to be doing a debate. So this is one of those conferences where you can bring people that don't agree with you, bring people that don't believe, and they'll be challenged, they'll be exposed, and it's one to get believers thinking. But you mentioned encouragement. Obviously, we can look at young people today and we can say, wow, how we're even losing some of the church generation. How can we get them on board with us and all the negative stats you see and so much in the culture happening that seems to be going the wrong direction? Yet I live with a constant sense of faith and hope and encouragement because I know the truth will triumph. What fuels the fire of encouragement in your life?
Well, I mean, I'm like you. I think I'm trying to read the tea leaves a little bit here and understand what the culture is doing. And what I see is there's a group that are shrinking, but the core of those people who have always identified themselves as Christian and actually understand what it is Christ taught and what it is that Christianity proposes, I honestly don't think that group is shrinking. I think there's just a reach and opportunity for us to reach people who in the past perhaps thought that Christianity was attractive, and maybe it was convenient, it was culturally acceptable, so they kind of consider themselves to be part of the club. But now they're really starting to wonder, is this really worth my time, considering it's no longer in that position of favor? So there are a lot of folks, we kind of call them the nuns. They check that box that says no religious affiliation on the reports when they are surveyed. But so they have, you know, like, what religious affiliation do you have? They would say none. Well, that's the group that I think is the best group for us to reach, because they have not checked the box that says atheist or agnostic. They've simply said, well, I used to be comfortable over here. I'm not so much anymore. Well, maybe it's because you've never considered the truth claims. Now, I know that God's Spirit has to do something in people before any of my case makes any sense. And I know that the case was not, I rejected the case. I wouldn't even listen to anyone who would offer the case until God's Spirit first did something in me. So I'm always praying for those people who come to an event like the SES conference, that God's going to do something to open up their eyes, and suddenly they're going to be sitting in that third or fourth row of that talk, and they are actually hearing for the first time stuff they probably heard before, But because God's Spirit had not yet, you know, opened their mind to this, it just kind of bounced off. I think that does happen every day. It certainly happened for me. And then God used the evidence to reach me. And that's what we do at SES, right, the National Conference. That's what the entire school is designed to do, is to train up leaders to be these kinds of case makers. And you see on the schedule there, Michael, you and Norm Geisler and Richard Land and you know, J.T. Bridges, all these folks are folks who were trained, Frank Turek, at SES. I feel like I'm just lucky to be invited at all, because this is a school that is cranking out case makers, cranking out people who can actually make the case for what they believe. And I think I'm just glad to be part of it.
You know, and I'm an adjunct or visiting professor over the years at seven different seminaries, and each school has certain qualities that are special. What I find when I'm at SES with students, their understanding of philosophy, their ability to engage the culture with the truth of the gospel is second to none. I taught a class once on the Book of Job there, and it was tremendous to have the level of discussion we did about the problem of evil and those kinds of things. So friends, ses.edu,
yeah.
That's where you find out about the school and the conference, conference.ses.edu. You can register there. Of course, there are always early bird registrations. And it's, just check it out. Check out who's going to be there, and you will be impacted by it. Brings me back to one last thing. When I went to a little church to pull my best friends out in 1971, my fellow band members that were starting to get interested in Jesus, so I went to pull them out as a heroin-shooting hippie rock drummer, and the first thing that happened was the people there were really nice to me. And whatever expectation I had, I didn't expect to be greeted by folks in their 60s at the door. So I'm 16. I'm 62 right now, but 60s, that was ancient to me, right?
Right.
Friendly, full of energy, love, nice, enthusiastic, the whole bit, and just loving me the way I was, this long-haired rebel full of hatred and anger. So the first thing that softened my heart was the people. I said to my friends, okay, you have your way, I have mine, you know, whatever. And then they started to pray for me. So the prayer part, the Holy Spirit, that's massive.
Yep.
And speaking the truth is massive, but also overcoming a lot of the stereotypical ideas that must happen when the young people and others hear you talk, because you're not one of these hateful religious right bigots that they're expecting.
Well, I can tell you, this is the hardest thing sometimes, I think, for those of us who would call ourselves apologists or case. We get so hung up on the head issues that we forget that what's most attractive, what changed the entire Roman Empire in the first 200 years, was the behavior and loving, obviously loving nature of Christian disciples. And so I think we kind of forget that, right? But if anyone should be expressing, I don't understand why any other group would out Christ us. And this does happen. We see it sometimes with our Mormon families and Mormon friends. They can sometimes do a better job of presenting the nature of Christ than the Christians do. So I think you're right. The call on our lives is to make sure that even though we're interested in the evidence and in worldview and in making the case, that we don't forget that the first thing that impacted you, the first thing that impacted my wife, the first thing that impacts the culture of the Roman Empire was the loving nature of Christians. Let's don't lose that. Let's don't forget that. It's not an either or, it's a both and.
Yeah, and if we have that love in our hearts, I tell people, when you cut us, we should bleed love.
That's
people
right.
will feel that. We could put up a false front, but when it's really in our hearts, then when God puts it in our heart, a real love for those who don't know him, people will feel that as we speak.
Yeah, and I think for us, the challenge is let's not reject the other side. You cannot be loving without a true understanding of what is true, without justice, without righteousness. Love is one thing, and I think we've shifted a little bit as a culture sometimes where loving is easier than knowing the truth and being able to articulate the truth. But we have to do both, I think, in order to be effective disciples.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, friends, J. Warner Wallace, if you don't have his book, Cold Case Christianity, start there. If you have that, find out about the book for kids, God's Crime Scene, Dealing with the Universe, and then hear J. Warner Wallace in person at the Apologetics Conference right in the middle of October, Charlotte, North Carolina. Go to conference.ses.edu. Jim, thanks for joining us. Been a great joy.
Looking forward to seeing you at the conference, Michael.
Yes, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I am going to change gears for one moment before I speak with my friend Peter LaBarbera about the National Education Association and more. But just want to comment on this briefly. I tweeted this out a little while ago, and I said, can we agree on this from all points of view? Let the whole truth about Russia and Trump be known and dealt with, and then let's move on. From day one, I've never believed that candidate Trump colluded with Russia to steal the election from Hillary Clinton. Whether Russia was involved, whether Russia hacked emails from the Democratic National Party, whether there are other things that Russia did, there's debate about that, but I never thought for a minute, and to this moment, there is not evidence of collusion between President Trump and Russia to steal the election from Hillary Clinton, period. I know it's reported constantly. Of course, you now have some of the behind-the-scenes tape with CNN producers and spokespeople or journalists there or contributors say that the whole thing's nothing. It's just a big nothing burger. It's just nothing. However, the big buzz now, Donald Trump Jr. Come on, he met with Russian leader. He met with an attorney from Russia, and it was about the election, and it was June of last year. So he has now released his emails. Now, please understand, if you're just tuning in, I am not a spokesman for the Republican Party. I'm not a registered Republican. I'm certainly not a spokesman for the Democratic Party. I'm an independent. I'm not a spokesperson for the president. When he does things that I think are right and good, I commend him. When he does things that grieve me, I address it, but with respect for him as our president and believing that God is using him in some very positive ways, but then there's some very negative things happening as well. So in that sense, again, I seek to speak the truth in love. If it offends everyone or offends no one, that's not my concern. My concern is to honor the Lord and to speak the truth in love. So Donald Jr. now has released the email chain, the email thread, leading up to this meeting with this woman from Russia. And what was sent to him was information saying, hey, this is highly sensitive, but there may be someone in Russia that has information on Hillary Clinton working with the Russians to influence the campaign. That's what it was about. It was not how can we work with Russia to influence the campaign, but there may be some dirt on Hillary Clinton. Well, unfortunately, this is the way of politics. If you've got some major dirt on the person that you expect to be running against, all right, and they are colluding with another nation to influence the elections, and you have information on that, that's quite damning. So he goes ahead with the meeting, but there was no such information. They were meeting about something else. That's what the woman wanted to speak to him about, was something else. So this is the big smoking gun. Oh, what's smoking gun? A friend wrote to me today, a critic of Trump, and said, have you seen, now what? What are you going to say to this? I said, say to what? The issue was Hillary Clinton colluding with Russia, and that's what Donald Trump Jr. was meeting about. And he released the e-thread about it. So bottom line, did someone set it up? Was Democrats setting it up to try to make the Trump campaign look bad? Who knows? I don't know, and that's not my issue right now. My only issue is that this thing just needs to go away so we can deal with issues that really have some substance. Like what's going to happen with healthcare? And what's going to happen with border security and our treatment of immigrants? And what's going to happen with our Middle East policy? And what's going to happen with our relationship to NATO and various issues and crisis? And what about North Korea? And then are Trump's appointees for the federal courts going to get through where Democrats try to stonewall them? Let's talk about issues of substance, all right? But let this nonsense go away. So whatever has to come to light, let it come to light. At a certain point, people are going to stop beating a dead horse. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on the broadcast today. Last week, I had on with me David Pickup and Sue Halverson, who were manning a booth. This is an ex-gay booth at the National Education Association and part of a group that is recognized as part of the NEA, but the NEA was trying to expel. We've got a video of the, a YouTube video of the audio interview that we did last week. You can listen to it at AskDrBrown.org. But my friend and colleague, Peter LaBarbera, has written an article on LifeSiteNews.com about the NEA and some of the extremism within it. This is the nation's largest union, and it's a very old union, over 150 years old. Teachers Union radically promotes transgender ideology and more. I want to talk to you about that and some other disturbing news. Peter, welcome back to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Mike. Thanks, and thanks for having me on. And believe it or not, I learned from Wikipedia that the NEA was once conservative.
Now, when were they conservative? How far back?
Well, I just checked out. I was looking at to see what Wiki had on it because they're generally very liberal. And they said that, a few decades ago, when the country was more conservative, the teachers' union was more conservative as well.
See, what's interesting, I researched them some in my book, Saving a Sick America, or for my book, Saving a Sick America, talking about the shift in education and how through the 1600s, 1700s, and 1800s in America, the Bible played a central role in our education but began to be phased out as you get later in the 1800s. And some of this was the influence of the NEA. So on the one hand, there has been a strong secularism in there, but it is interesting that, as you say, as the country was more conservative because you've got more conservative teachers and administrators, it would make sense that the NEA was more conservative. How far left has this union, this teachers and educators union, gone now?
Well, it's just absolutely incredible, Mike, as you know. And when you start, my oldest friend, M. Stanton Evans, was a great conservative journalist, not a religious man by any stretch, but he had something called the law of insufficient paranoia. And I generally find that comes true with the LGBTQIAP now, whatever the acronym is, agenda, because it just continues to get more radical. But what struck me was the solutions, which I guess we're going to talk about, but also the stridency of the NEA's president. I hadn't checked into the NEA until, in the last few months anyway, and I wasn't aware that the NEA's president, a woman named Escalin Garcia, she has a gay son. She's very radical, and you can just hear her radicalism, which I'm sure she's well-meaning, of course, but it comes out as being very, very, very radical on this particular issue.
Right. So is this a matter of we have diversity of views in our midst? This is my view, but we welcome all other views, or we only welcome some views here?
Well, based on the story we're both talking about with the ex-gays, this is once again the liberal definition of tolerance, which is actually intolerant. Like you've taught many people, Mike, that tolerance used to be we could have a civil discussion, even though we disagree. We could be polar opposites, but we have a civil debate. But now they're talking about booting the ex-gay educators as well as the creationists, and this is just the standard way of operating for the liberal side, especially on the homosexual and transgender issue. They don't regard us as a legitimate viewpoint. They classify our viewpoint as hatred, and then they find means to basically ban that viewpoint, which looks like they're getting ready to do for 2018.
So, in other words, their justification is we are intolerant of bigotry. We should not be tolerant towards groups like the KKK or tolerant towards Nazis. And you are just like them. You are just as evil. So that's how they caricature us. And it seems that many people actually believe that because they come up to David and Sue, who are loving people, they come up to them as if they're the devil themselves, don't they?
Right. And I think what happens is they start believing their own propaganda. And if they would just sit down and talk to you, I've told many people about you, Mike, because I think you're one of the great representatives of our side on speaking the truth in love. But as you know, you could be Mother Teresa and stand against gay marriage and they'd still say you're a hater. So it fits that narrative. They can't. I think it demonstrates the weakness of their side. If they're so petrified of even hearing from ex-gays, they know they must fear something. And I think what they fear is the destruction of their narrative that you're basically inherent or inborn homosexual or transgender. This is who you are. It's inherently who you are. And if there are ex-gays, people who once lived that lifestyle and now are happily out of it and not, are living good lives, happy lives, contented lives, that destroys that narrative.
Right. So you cannot threaten some of the foundational lies. And we're not saying this to demonize all those who identify as LGBT or say you're all liars. We are saying that some of the pillars of the movement, you're born this way, you can't change, it's innate and immutable, or 10% of the population is gay, or gay is the new black, that these are all falsehoods, yet they're falsehoods that have moved the country, moved public opinion. So for that to be challenged in any way, theoretically, the whole structure, the building blocks fall apart. So have you seen over the years, you've been at this for many years, burdened to address this for years, that as people find out the truth, their viewpoint on the activism changes?
Yes. And I think that's why the media censors us, Mike.
Yeah.
If only 1% of the American public were to read your book, your Queer Indeed book, A Queer Thing Happened to America, I'm sorry, or other great resources like that, I think things would change. And so that's what I'm talking about, the weakness of the gay side. You know, it used to be that you said, look, if you really want to, if we're not afraid, me and you would not be afraid to debate a Nazi. If we really were Nazis, they should let us speak. But they really, I think, know deep down that we're not Nazis. And so they're just using that as a tactic. Because if you really have bad speech, you just let that speech go and people will know that it's bad speech. What they're doing instead is they've done everything they can to block, especially the ex-gays. And it's not just the LGBT movement. It's also, you know, powerful media people like Oprah. You know, why didn't Oprah Winfrey ever have an ex-gay on her very popular TV show? That would have been you'd think the media would be curious and want to have those people on, but so few do.
Yeah, and obviously there's tremendous threat. Look, some years ago, GLAAD, which was originally the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, then I renamed it the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Disagreement, and now they just call themselves GLAAD. They don't even use the acronym. They put out, it started with 36, now the number's grown, a commentator accountability project where they went to the secular networks and said, don't have Michael Brown on. Don't have, or when Chuck Colson was like, don't have Chuck Colson on. Don't have Tony Perkins on. Don't have Peter LaBarbera on. Don't have these people on because they're going to pollute people's thinking. They are not really experts. They have no right to speak on these subjects, and you should not allow their point of view. So this is even saying on a liberal network where it's going to be skewed, they might have three liberals and you on the panel for discussion, and you might get a minute in edgewise. No, don't even let that minute in because it's going to negatively influence people's thinking. When you have the truth, you know, when I go to do a lecture on a campus, I request a debate. I said, can we do a debate instead? I want someone from the other side to present their point of view the best they can because we've got nothing to fear when we're dealing with the truth. When you're not on the side of truth, you can't bring everything into the light. And that's why it's so important that you keep doing and others keep doing what they do. Peter, what is it that got you moved to get involved in this? You've been a journalist, reporter with Washington Times and others. There are a lot of easier battles to face. I know you've had virtually no funding for this. You've done this sacrificially. Your family sacrificed together with you. What is it that caused you to take a stand?
Well, I had finally read my Bible. I knew what the truth was about homosexuality, not that we only get our truth from the Bible. But what I saw as a young sort of activist with and writer with Concerned Women for America, I started researching the gay lobby, And that was 25 years ago, Mike. And I thought, wow, there's a huge thing growing here. Not many people know about how radical this is. So I used their own sources to educate people. For example, once we exposed that a very large gay international consortium had pedophile groups as among its members, we would use their own sources to show what it was all about. But, Mike, 25 years ago, I think the movement then was probably 1/100th the size it is today. In fact, I would speculate that the transgender movement alone, the transgender lobby, probably spends more on the LGBT issue than the entire Christian pro-family movement on all of the agenda.
All right, we're going to continue on this. I have a new article, When the Church Celebrates Same-Sex Surgery. We'll be right back with my guest, Peter LaBarber.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm speaking with my friend and colleague, Peter LaBarber. His website, Americans for Truth About Homosexuality, that's AFTAH.org. You can read his columns on LifeSite News. Looking at a column from end of June, schools must refer to students by preferred gender pronoun or face investigation. June 20th, pro-abortion actress tweets, "You don't need a father," on Father's Day. June 20th, gay activists sexualize and exploit young girl after coming out as lesbian in Mormon church service. June 16th, if gays are so tolerant, why are they disrupting an ex-gay conference? All these articles, they're well-researched, they're clearly laid out, they are practical. Peter, I remember maybe the first time we talked on the radio, I asked you why you stay at this, and you said something very simple, but I've quoted it since, "I'll stop when they stop." And in other words, this is not a battle we were looking for. There are plenty of other things I'd like to write about and address. Of course, we do address other things, but to constantly have to address the latest aspect of transgender activism, and now the Church of England is considering whether they have a special blessing ceremony for sex change surgery and things like that, and the madness we're confronted with in the schools, that this continues to knock at our door, and we're simply responding with truth and reporting things to a culture that, and a church that still often doesn't want to hear about it. So Peter, if you could say something to pastors and leaders who are listening, and if you could get in their ear and urge them to hear you, what would you say to them about the importance of them engaging these cultural issues?
Mike, I think it's all about the truth. And it's more than just confronting this morally. This also is going to have a big impact on the Bible and on the gospel. Mike, I don't know if you saw that story where our education secretary, Betsy DeVos, who, by the way, has a pretty strong pro-LGBT record, even though she identifies as a Christian. It's very strange, but she has this side of her. And but to her credit, she said that she was being grilled in Congress about vouchers. And they said, well, what about vouchers to this Indiana school? Let's say you had Indiana was receiving federal vouchers for education, and they allow vouchers to be given to religious schools. And they raised the example of this very fine-looking Christian school in Indiana, and she said she would just let them go by their local, you know, they can distribute it as they choose. And the left went crazy. Why did they go crazy? Because they want to control. They want to tell religious schools what they can and cannot teach. This is going on much further in Canada, but we're well on our way. We see the ACLU suing Catholic schools because they don't want to sanction homosexual married, so-called married employees. This has a huge implication for our religious liberty, but also for the gospel. And now we have so-called gay Christians, which you've written about very eloquently, Mike. I think they are the most radical gay activists now because they're saying that they're redefining Christianity in the name of rationalizing their homosexuality, which goes about as far as you can go. It's the conservative gays now who pose the bigger threat, because they're purporting to redefine truth and even Christian biblical truth itself as part of their self-rationalizing project.
Right. So originally it went from, look, of course, religious people don't agree with us, and we know what you say the Bible teaches, and so on. So that's not our issue. We just want the right to do what we're doing. Now it's basically telling the religious world, you're going to have to conform, otherwise there are going to be penalties. And that brings us back to something.
Can I say one thing, Mike?
Yeah,
please. Remember also, it also was, we'll never go into schools. We don't want anything to do with children.
Exactly.
And now they're saying schools must teach even toddlers about transgenderism.
Yes. And when you say remember, most people don't even know that because they weren't alert to what was happening in the early days of gay activism. So let's think of this for a moment. The first gay activist that came out in major numbers was Stonewall in 1969. It was very militant. It was very blatant. It was, you know, nude marches down the streets, and we're here, we're queer, get used to it. And then gay strategists put their heads together and said, this is not working. We're not changing the culture. And kind of the more savvy conservative side won out. Let's just present gay man as, you know, your great typical couple, you know, faithful married couple together for many years. And we've been caricatured the wrong way, so we'll go the other way. We'll go a little extreme in the positive caricature. And that's how we'll turn public opinion. And we need to police our gay pride events and so on. So, of course, with that strategy, massive, massive changes have come. And with that strategy, there's been much more acceptance of same-sex, quote, marriage, and now little by little even transgender activism. But the more things are getting accepted, it seems to me, Peter, that things are coming more out of the closet now. So now you have drag queens reading stories in libraries to two-year-olds. This wouldn't have happened a few years ago, but it's almost like now that more things are accepted, that everybody can just come out of the closet, and now the whole agenda has to be accepted.
Right, right. And I did a story on an eight-year-old drag queen, so-called.
Yeah.
This is in Canada, where the mother actually encouraged the son to dress as a woman. And, you know, it's appalling. But the question is, will the blowback from all this, is our culture degraded to the point where they know they can just push this, or will there be pushback coming? I think I'm seeing on the transgender issue, there's a lot of people who are very upset. In fact, Tucker Carlson seems to be getting more and more conservative on this as he realizes something's got to be done because nobody is saying no. Now, what really distresses me is it seems like the Republican Party has pretty much pulled out of this debate. And as you said at the beginning of the show, the gay lobby never stops. They're always driving. They're always on offense. We always seem to be on defense.
Yeah, exactly. And that is the question. Has the culture degraded so much that we are so desensitized that anything goes, or is there still that window, and I believe there is, but it's closing quickly, where people just say, hey, I didn't sign up for this. And yes, we're seeing the pushback on the transgender issue. We're seeing folks say, look, I think if you love each other, you should be able to be married, and I want to be a tolerant person, but I didn't sign up to have a 15-year-old boy playing on my girl's softball team and sharing the shower stalls with her. I didn't sign up for that.
Mike, here's what scares me. I talked to a young conservative kid, a Republican, who wants to be a conservative talk show host. He's getting high school, really good kid. And he basically said, well, I think they ought to be able to get married, but. And so I said to him, well, wait a minute. That's not marriage. That's policy, public policy based on a lie. And what we see is this incrementalism, this relativism, where people, you know, it's always the next thing. And so what I fear is that 20 years from now, people will say, well, I think it's okay to have transgender rights, but pedophilia is too much. You know, so we've got to get back to the basics.
Yes.
And I think that is about homosexual behavior, and get to the behaviors, because they won by making this all about discrimination, equality, all these abstract ideas, when it's really about normalizing and legitimizing immoral behavior.
Yeah, and something that's very contrary to God's design, which is why our message is, we're a fallen human race. Jesus died for everyone. Come to him as you are, but come to him to be changed, not to stay as you are. Hey, Peter, keep up the good work. Your labor is not in vain.
You too, Mike.
God bless. From the defense of the faith to the education system of our nation to hope for revival, all coming your way today, right here.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I read a story about Ronald Reagan this week I had never heard before. It is verified. It is accurate. It is known to those close to the Reagans to be true. But I just found out about it this week, and I'm going to share it with you shortly. This is Michael Brown. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Line of Fire broadcast. I was thinking today about Joshua chapter 5. Do you remember the account there? Joshua and the children of Israel are about to invade the land of Canaan and take the promised land, and they're going to first do war with Jericho. One of the most famous stories in the Bible is the walls of Jericho come tumbling down supernaturally. Well, before the battle, Joshua encounters the angel of the Lord, described as the captain of the Lord's armies, all right? Joshua chapter 5. Some would argue that it was the Son of God himself appearing. So let me share this account, and then I want to tie it in with today, you and me, and politics. So when Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked. And behold, a man was standing before him with his drawn sword in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, "Are you for us or for our adversaries?" And he said, "No." I love that answer. "No. Whose side are you on? Are you for us? Or are you for our adversaries?" I mean, because he sees a man with a drawn sword, all right? And as far as he knows, he's a soldier. Maybe he recognizes him as being an angelic ambassador, but he knows he's a soldier. He's got a drawn sword. He's not just there working a field or something like that, or taking a walk to another village. He's there with a drawn sword. So whose side are you on? Are you for us or for our adversaries? And he said, "No, but I am the commander of the army of the Lord. Now I have come." And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped him and said to him, "What does my Lord say to his servant?" And the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, "Take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy." On a certain level, friends, the posture and position of the angel of the Lord should be similar to ours. What do I mean? When it comes to, are you Republican or Democrat? Are you for the president or against the president? I'm not saying, by the way, that you can't have a party affiliation. I'm an independent, but that does not mean that's the only way to go, all right? That's just my personal choice and expression. But it's not a matter of are you for or against Barack Obama? Are you for or against Donald Trump? No. I'm for the Lord and the truth of the Lord. I'm for righteousness and justice and mercy and compassion. I'm for what is right, not what is popular, not what is politically expedient, but what is right. And therefore, if I see something right and good, it doesn't matter if it's Democrat, Republican, Independent, Libertarian. If I see something that's right and good, I can commend it. If I see something that's wrong and hurtful, doesn't matter if it's Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, Independent, I will address that. That is the goal. And ultimately, as God's people, not all of you have a microphone like I do or a platform like I do. I mean, we all have some platform, some influence there. All of us touch some other lives somewhere, somehow. But as far as our posture, as far as our attitude, I was not an Obama opponent. I am not a Trump loyalist. Because of my devotion to the Lord, I took issue with certain policies of President Obama, agreed with some of President Trump, but then take issue with other things. Follow me?
Give us strength to always do what's right.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Friends, I'm committed to this. I'm serious. I am committed to this moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. I live it. I breathe it. It's in my blood. I can't get away from it. Jesus changes us, and we go and change our world through the gospel. I'm not talking about taking over the society and enforcing our views and imposing our views on society. I've said that countless times. But rather, as we are changed by the gospel, we bring that same gospel to the society around us. As we are impacted by the truth, we speak the truth to the world. And what's the alternative? Hibernate? Stagnate? Go in a closet? Friends, cowardice is crippling. Billy Graham said that courage is contagious, but cowardice is crippling. Let me digress now. Well, not digress. I digressed for a minute speaking about moral culture revolution. Let me get back to something I said I wanted to talk to you about. And then want to share with you briefly from my new article, When the Church Celebrates Sex Change Surgery. Yeah, the Church of England is, quote, considering special services to celebrate gender reassignment. There's an article on the stream written by Mark Tooley, and it's called Reagan's Evangelism. Now, I have friends that knew Ronald Reagan and spoke of his Christian faith being genuine and life-changing. I never knew how deeply committed to the Lord he was because I didn't know him, and I've never studied his life in depth. But there is a book by H.W. Brands, a historian, and it's a new biography of Ronald Reagan. And there's a paragraph that Mark Tooley cites. During Reagan's second year in office, his father-in-law, Lloyd Davis, became seriously ill. Reagan wrote in his diary, Nancy's very depressed about her father's health, and understandably so. Davis and Nancy's mother had retired to Scottsdale, Arizona, and his illness prompted repeated flights by Nancy across the country from Washington. Reagan liked and respected his father-in-law, was naturally concerned for his health, but he worried more about his spiritual health. Reagan wrote, he's always been an agnostic. Now I think he knows fear for probably the first time in his life. So the biographer continues, H.W. Brands, Reagan couldn't take the time Nancy did to visit Davis, but he wished he could. I want so much to speak to him about faith, he said. I believe this is a moment when he should turn to God, and I want so much to help him do that. Yet Reagan never found the time, and Davis died a few months later with Reagan's words unspoken. Ah, but Mark Tooley points this out. Friends, I found this fascinating, and I think you'll be encouraged by it. He says, but Reagan did find the time to contact his troubled father-in-law, even if he could not visit. And who told the story? Nancy Reagan, July 27th, 1988, to 10,000 delegates to the Students' Congress on Evangelism. The event was hosted by Youth for Christ at the Washington Convention Center. So she spoke, and then Ronald Reagan spoke the next day. But listen to what Nancy Reagan says, July 27th, 1988. My father, who died 6 years ago, was a brilliant man, an internationally known brain surgeon. He was a person of tremendous self-confidence and intellect, so it is ironic that his spiritual life was influenced by a small, petty event that happened in his childhood. When he was a boy, there was a contest in his Sunday school class. The winner was to receive a Bible. My father knew he'd won the contest, for even then he was totally confident in himself and his abilities. He simply couldn't accept it when the Bible was given to the child of the minister, and in reaction, my father, feeling wronged and disillusioned, allowed no place for faith in his life for the next 80 years. He would take my mother and me to church and Sunday school, Nancy Reagan said, but he'd leave and come back only when it was time to pick us up. My mother had a very deep religious faith. She read her Bible every night, and it was that deep and abiding faith that helped her tremendously at the end of her life. But my father didn't have that, and at the end of his life, he was terribly frightened. He was even afraid to go to sleep for fear he wouldn't wake up. He moved from chair to chair trying to keep awake and, I guess, alive. I can't tell you how much it hurt him. It hurt to see him this way. this man who had always been so supremely confident and strong in my eyes. My husband, she's talking about Ronald Reagan, wrote him two long letters explaining the encompassing comfort he'd receive if he just put himself in the Lord's hands. This is President Ronald Reagan, the evangelist, reaching out to his father-in-law, writing him two long letters. Nancy Reagan said this, "I was at the hospital with him, with her father, but my father never mentioned to me what happened next. The doctors told me. 2 days before he died, he asked to see the hospital chaplain. I don't know what the chaplain did or what he said, but whatever it was the right thing, and it gave my father comfort. I noticed he was calmer and not as frightened. When he died the next day, he was at peace, finally, and I was so happy for him. My prayers were answered." Mark Tooley says, "I vividly recall 29 years ago as a young man reading about Nancy Reagan's emotional remarks. I was moved that the president had taken time from his brutal schedule to offer spiritual counsel to his dying father-in-law. I've never found the story in any history book or biography. It's very hard to find any account online." And then he gives some examples of it and a video of the speech of Nancy Reagan. He said, "But wouldn't it be fascinating to see the two long letters Reagan wrote to his father-in-law? They presumably survived, likely at the Reagan Library, but I've never seen them quoted. I hope they surface. That would tell us a lot about the man and his faith." Now, let me throw something out to you, all right? For everyone who is upset with President Trump, for everyone who feels he has degraded the presidency, for everyone who feels that his tweets have been destructive and have lowered decency in America, for everyone that does not trust him in his dealings with other nations, for everyone who still believes he's a misogynist and maybe a racist or a bigot or a Muslim hater or whatever. So I'm speaking to some of you. Others are like, "What are you talking about? He's God's man. God raised him up." I understand that maybe most of you listening to me are more pro-Trump than anti-Trump, but certainly, even among believers, there are many who have a real problem with the president. I am not saying that Donald Trump now is like Ronald Reagan was. I am not saying that. We know the different method of communication that Ronald Reagan used. We know how he would take a higher ground against his ideological opponents, but in a way that did not make him look bad. It pushed them down and exposed their wrong way of thinking, but it was in a way that did not make him look bad himself, all right? And I'm not saying that Donald Trump has a real relationship with the Lord as Ronald Reagan did. And God knows, God knows. But what I'm saying is this. Most conservatives and objective historians recognize that Ronald Reagan was a very effective president, that Ronald Reagan was instrumental in the collapse of the Iron Curtain, that Ronald Reagan was a blessing to the pro-life movement, even though we continued to abort babies through his administration just as at the beginning. He was still a friend of the pro-life movement. Most of us look at him in very, very positive light. But would you have picked a Ronald Reagan to be the president? Divorced, remarried, Hollywood actor, and not even one of the best Hollywood actors? I remember a few decades ago, Nancy and I renting a movie that we watched with our kids, Bedtime for Bonzo. Bonzo being the pet chimpanzee, starring Ronald Reagan. Yeah. Would you have picked him? I wouldn't have. There are many others I would have picked, but God picked him. Yeah, I voted for him. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying as far as years earlier, saying here's the man I'm going to use, no way. So we're not denying Donald Trump's baggage. We're not denying his ongoing faults. At least I'm not. I wrote an article a few weeks ago, "Don't Sell Your Soul," defending the president. Okay? So, In short, I'm not denying the past problems or the current problems. I'm simply saying, ask yourself a question. Could it be that God raised him up for a purpose nonetheless, and that God is continuing to work on his heart? And as people have said, Justice Neil Gorsuch already doing a great job, but he's not yet 50 years old. If he lives to be healthy and strong, he could be serving 30 years on the Supreme Court, and there could be others like him that follow. There's some very major things taking place that Donald Trump is making good decisions on. Perhaps God is at work in the midst of this in ways beyond what we know. That's it. That's what I wanted to share. In any case, pray for the man, would you?
God of light, hear our cry. Send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I just tweeted this out a little while ago during a break. Jesus says to us, come as you are, not stay as you are. Jesus does not practice affirmational inclusion, but transformational inclusion. In other words, he doesn't say to a lost sinner, I affirm you in your sin. He doesn't say, come to me and I will affirm you in your sin. He says, come to me and I will save you out of your sin. Come to me and I will transform you from your sin. When he hung out with the tax collectors, when he hung out with the prostitutes, remember the tax collectors were notorious for extortion. When he hung out with them, he was a friend of sinners, was he not? But did he teach the prostitutes how to make more money? Did he teach the tax collectors how to extort more money? Is that what he did? Or did he change them? They were around him, and by being around him, they came out of their sin. Matthew, the tax collector, comes out of his sin. Others, Luke 7, the immoral woman, she comes out of her sin as a result of the encounter with Jesus. Zacchaeus, the tax collector, as a result of his encounter with Jesus, he turns away from his sin. So many times, friends, the church today, wanting to be compassionate, wanting to be kind. What happens is the church today embraces sin in the name of compassion. It does far more harm than good. It misleads, it misguides, it destroys. So the latest news, Church of England is now considering special services to celebrate gender reassignment. And I'm saddened by it, disappointed by it, but I'm not surprised at all. First, the handwriting's been on the wall for a while now in terms of the increasingly liberal direction of the Church of England. And other groups, other religious groups, have already instituted special ceremonies for people, quote, transitioning. So I'm disappointed, I'm saddened, but I'm not surprised. But let's look at this from the viewpoint, though, of an LGBT activist, all right? Let's look at this from the viewpoint of someone who says, I'm a Christian, and I care for the LGBT community. And here's what they might say. Look, Jesus calls us to come to him as we are with all our blemishes and sins. And the gospel of grace tells us that we don't need to clean up our act before we can be accepted by God. So Vicar Chris Newlands said, Church of England vicar, I hope that we can make a powerful statement that we believe trans people are cherished and loved by God who created them. So they would ask questions like, well, what sin is a transgender person committing? If they genuinely believe they were born in the wrong body, why can't they pursue a surgical and hormonal solution? Why should this be treated differently than any physical or emotional handicap? Let these troubled souls find relief wherever they can, rather than condemn them, celebrate them. That would be the voice of liberal Christianity, with some truth mixed in with error. The Right Reverend Paul Bays said, as the world listens to us today, the world needs to hear us say that LGBTI orientation and identity is not a crime, not a sickness, and not a sin. Well, if you're saying that someone that feels same-sex attracted is not sinning by having a feeling, or someone who struggles with gender identity, a man who feels he's trapped in a woman's body, that's what he believes, or a man who believes, he's a woman trapped in a man's body, is that a sin to have that feeling? Well, no, that's not the issue. The issue is endorsing it. The issue is normalizing it. The issue is celebrating it. The issue is acting on it. So the liberal line of reasoning replaces divine wisdom with human wisdom, and it substitutes a misguided earthly compassion for a truth-based, scripturally grounded compassion. So so-called progressive Christianity embraces same-sex, quote, marriage because, well, love is love. But a biblically based faith recognizes God's plan for marriage as sacred and unalterable. And it's not just from Genesis. Jesus himself reinforces marriage is the union of one man and one woman. It's God's intent from the beginning, from creation. So-called progressive Christianity endorses homosexual behavior because, hey, this is the way God made me. Biblically based faith recognizes homosexual desires as part of our fallen nature, something to be rejected as sinful and redeemed through the cross. So-called progressive Christianity celebrates sex change surgery because a struggling soul has found wholeness. Biblically based faith understands sex change surgery to be a mutilation of a healthy body, knowing that God can make us whole from the inside out. Now, Church of England has been lurching towards embracing gay, quote, marriage in recent years. So it's no surprise that they're considering now special ceremonies to celebrate someone's sex change surgery. But none of this surprises me. In 2011, in my book, A Queer Thing Happened to America, so we're talking 6 years now, six and a quarter years since the book came out, and then I'm documenting things that happened in the years prior, so some of this could go back 7 years, some 10, some 15, some 20, that Reform Judaism, which is the most liberal main wing of Judaism, now has a series of blessings. I wrote this in 2011, to be recited over sex change surgery. Part of the revised 500-page manual called Kulanu, meaning all of us, a program for implementing gay and lesbian inclusion, a 500-page manual for Reform Judaism. And as I ask, in A Queer Thing Happened to America, can you imagine praying a prayer whose sentiments are roughly equivalent to, God, we ask you to bless our efforts as we radically alter your creation and design through mutilating surgeries of perfectly healthy body parts and organs in keeping with our preferences and needs? It gets worse, though. And I know there are always young ears listening, so let me say this as delicately as I can. In the homosexual community, there are even, especially male, there are far more anonymous encounters, we'll just call them anonymous encounters with people, than in the heterosexual community. Well, gay synagogues in San Francisco and New York now have a blessing for, quote, unexpected intimacy. Yeah, uh-huh. Unexpected intimacy meant to be recited after engaging in anonymous acts. Though those involved in the project say it could also be said for other meaningful encounters with strangers. So you meet somebody you don't even know, you are intimate with that person, and now you have a blessing that you say, including the blessing God who created passion and wove it throughout creation. And that this encounter that you had with this person, you're talking about a sexually immoral, perverse act. You're now praying that it allows us to both touch and see the divine. You're giving thanks for that. Friends, when you see stuff that sick, it should not surprise you at all that the Church of England is going in the direction that it is going. Friends, we welcome everyone, come as you are, and we tell you, God has a better way.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I want to tell you a little story. This is Michael Brown. Welcome to the line of fire. One of my dearest friends in the world, Yesupadam from India, will often see things that others don't see. We'll see situations as opportunities for the gospel. And there have been people that took advantage of him when he was an untouchable, that mistreated him when he was a young boy, working for pennies and not even getting paid and going days without eating, taken advantage of by the society and by certain individuals. And then later in life, as a believer with a large ministry and an extraordinary humanitarian arm, greatly respected by the local government, he has now encountered some of the people that took advantage of him when he was a boy. He has dealt with wealthy people that mistreated him and scorned him, even as a believer. And he has used these opportunities to serve those that came against him many years ago in order to see them recognize the love of God and come to faith. And rather than retaliating and rather than writing them off, he treated them with the love of God. He served them in ways that you think, don't bend over backwards to serve people like this after they have mistreated you and taken advantage of you. But he has done that when they fell on hard times, reached out and helped them, as a result of which they have now come to faith and honor him as if he was their father. In other words, he saw something that others didn't see. And rather than seeing the situation as unredeemable or hopeless or too late or too far gone, he saw it as an opportunity for the gospel. That's how I'm looking at the nation of America right now. As I said yesterday, it was some months back when I felt the Lord just whisper to me in prayer one day, write a book on the fall and rise of America. If you didn't watch our 3-minute trailer yet, this is part of the introduction to Saving a Sick America, my newest book. If you didn't watch the trailer, just 3 minutes long, go to our YouTube channel, Ask Dr. Brown, A-S-K-D-R Brown on YouTube, and you'll see it listed, Saving a Sick America. America. By the way, we have over 900 videos there for you. Over 900, including debates on a wide range of subjects, including teaching videos, preaching videos, excerpts from the radio show, interviews, and different discussions of all kinds. But you will be impacted. People are loving this video. Got a note late last night from a colleague. What a compelling video. Multiple exclamation points to paint a picture of how far we have fallen. And yet, I'm looking at this with pain, with grief, but with great hope that this great darkness in which we live provides the perfect backdrop for life and light to shine. That to the degree the society is messed up and is not rightly understanding God and marriage and family and moral values and things that he has established, the Lord has established for our good, to the extent the society is not getting it, to that extent, we have an opportunity to show them a better way. So if you haven't watched this yet, go to the Ask Dr. Brown YouTube channel and just watch the promo for Saving a Sick America. I think you'll be moved by it. And the book is written to lay out in every major area of society, here is God's wisdom, here is God's way. There is a prescription for moral and cultural transformation. If you'd like to pre-order a signed and numbered copy of the book, just go to my website, askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. You'll be the first to get them. They'll be signed and numbered when they come out in September. Right back with my friend, James Robinson.
Cleansing flame, send the fire. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to The Line of Fire broadcast. Michael Brown here. If you've not yet seen my latest article, When the Church Celebrates Sex Change Surgery, it is up at thestream.org. If you're also looking for perspectives on what's happening in the world today, from politics to dealing with North Korea, what about Charlie Gard, the baby in the UK? Great timely pieces on the stream, stream.org, that are practical, that are faith-based, that are relevant. James, welcome back to The Line of Fire. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, it's a joy to be here, Michael, and it was a joy to spend about an hour with you and other stream leaders and writers just seeking the mind of the Father so that we can share the heart and the will of the Father faithfully with all these various tributaries flowing truth on the website, thestream.org. I think it's critically important that we realize there's one major part, and it's Him. There's one important part, it's Christ. And all of us are pointing to Him as His body submitted to His head. And we're really seeking to do that on the stream so that no tributary becomes the river, but we're all flowing into the river of truth for the glory of God and the benefit of the hearers.
Yeah, and there's a great group that has been assembled. You and Jay Richards and others putting the team together. I'm always amazed by what I'm reading there, and the spiritual insights and from folks from a wide range of background, but all seeking to go to the throne of God, from whence the stream flows, and through His Word, and get His heart and mind, because God's never reacting to what's happening in society around us. And the last half hour, I mentioned the Mark Tooley article on the evangelism of Ronald Reagan, where it talks about his faith and reaching out to his father-in-law, and what an unlikely candidate he was. But you were part of that. You saw something, and Billy Graham, James Dobson, and others saw something in Ronald Reagan, how God could use him, whereas others didn't see it. God's perspective is often different than ours. And you recently put out a video on Facebook having to do with seeing and not really seeing. Talk to us about that.
Well, I think the eyes of the world has blinded the eyes of the been blinded by the eyes of the unbelieving, because the enemy, the god of the world, has blinded them. But a lot of Christians have no vision, and they're living defeated. And it's just really sad that the unseen world controls what we see in the world, because we're not aware of these principalities and powers that are manipulating people to their own demise. You know, Paul said when he was writing in Acts that you wouldn't even believe it if someone told you these things that are truth. You're scoffers, you marvel and perish. God said, I'm accomplishing a work in your day, a work you wouldn't believe, though someone should describe it. And he's referring back to the book of Habakkuk and how the Chaldeans had taken the people of God captive and like fish in a net and led them around like they're on a hook. We talk about people who are repeatedly defeated as being hooked, but they don't realize they've been manipulated at that point of vulnerability by the deceiver and the predator who has literally taken them captive to their own demise. And many Christians are living not knowing that the enemy has entered Jerusalem. He's entered the house of God. He's thrown down everything sacred in the sanctuary, and we're the temple of God. And, you know, if you don't have the house occupied with the Spirit, then Jesus said the enemy that was driven out through deliverance and through freedom will come back and bring seven more spirits with him, and the house will be worse than the first day it was in. And this is the way it is with many people in church. They look like a chain gang when they come in too often. They're just going through traditional motion and teaching those traditions that don't liberate. And they have actually been snared by the devil, held captive by him against their will. And we're going to have to see the influence of this unseen world. It's in the realm of politics. It's in the realm of business. The fact that people can be successful, Michael, is not a problem. That's what freedom offers, people who are dedicated. But greed is a problem. And greed will hold selfish people captive. And the people who don't have anything, with covetousness toward those who have, and even a hatred, it just tears the human race apart. And it destroys the will of God for every life that He loved so deeply and gave His Son to redeem. So I'm talking about getting our eyes open so that we don't have to be controlled by the unseen forces of evil, but we can be controlled by the power of the Spirit. If we're going to deal with our natural desires and appetites, we have to have supernatural desires and supernatural appetites. If we're going to deal with unnatural desires and appetites, we have to have the power of the supernatural realm and the realm of that spirit to deal even with unnatural appetites. So we need to develop appetites for the things of God, the Word of God, the truth of God, the will of God, and submit to that, and we can be lifted by God as overcomers. I want to close this little part of our discussion with this reality. If I looked at my life, I cannot say that I never failed, never was defeated, was never thrown in a pit, never fell in a pit, never found myself in a pit that I dug with my own deeds, because I've been in the pit for all those reasons. But let me tell you something I can say that is positive. I have always been determined not to stay in the pit. I've been determined to get out of the pit. The moment we give in to living in the pit, to live in defeat, to leave with the enemy's foot on our neck, we have just rejected the one who's kneeling by the pit, however we got there, inclining his ear, extending his hand as surely as the father of the prodigal who looked every day for the return of that boy he loves deeply. The moment you don't want out of that pit, you have just said no to the person that loves you so much that he is kneeling right there by the pit you're in, anxiously waiting to lift you up and set your feet on a solid foundation. And I pray God will help everybody that's been defeated or is defeated to understand there is a deliverer who can deliver us to the uttermost. And I am praying for that to happen. People's eyes get open so they can see the realm of the spirit and the invisible realm as it affects the visible.
Yeah, and that's why the things that drive you are always compassion and redemption. Because when we're in the flesh, we just see problems and issues, and someone hurts us, we want to hurt them back. When we have divine sight, we see everything as an opportunity for God to be glorified. We can see past someone's failings and blemishes and see God's purposes for them. You know, there's a woman I used to work with in Focus in the Family that helped in ministry people dealing with homosexuality, and she came out of lesbianism. I only knew her, James, as a very godly woman and very Christ-like. She gave her testimony at my home congregation one day and put up an old picture of her as this caricatured butch lesbian, cigarette in her mouth. And you would have walked past that person saying, she will never listen to the gospel. And God made a jewel out of her. So often we just see after the flesh and we don't see after the spirit. We don't have that compassionate, redemptive side. But that's driven your ministry for decades now.
Well, I've experienced that deliverance. And I know what it is to be fatherless and to have the ultimate father who not only knows best, but he cares for all of us so deeply. I wish everyone listening could somehow begin to comprehend how much the Father loves them. There are no small parts in his body. There are no unimportant parts in the body of Christ. Every person is precious. Every person is special to God. They've been designed by the Lord in a unique fashion to accomplish a unique purpose in God's kingdom will right here on this earth. I pray people will see that. He loves them so much. And I do pray people will go to the stream. And as you know, I'm beginning to post on Facebook now. I'm going to be there quite often. I posted right after I talked to you this morning sitting in my car. I did a post. And I'm going to just be sharing. I told everyone right as I was going through eye surgery, and it's been miraculous. And I share that on Facebook. And I want spiritual miraculous healing of people's eyes. But I let everyone know that they will hear a father's heart and a grandfather's heart when I talk. But my deep desire is that they will hear the heart of the Father. And you pray that for me. I know you are, Dr. Brown, and everyone listening. But just know I'm going to do my best to share the heart of the Father with the family he loves and with all the people who don't know him, but he gave his son to redeem them and bring them into the family.
Yeah, isn't it amazing, especially the younger generation and its fatherlessness, how they will gather around spiritual fathers? There's a guy that became an internet sensation from England, a grandfather. just put these headphones on and sits there behind his computer, and it's a lousy setting. There's nothing good about it graphically, but just talked as a grandfather and has gotten this massive following. It says something about the needs of this generation.
Well, really and truly, you know, what our national leaders need to realize is that they can't communicate with the American people without going around the media. And I said this to Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan was a great communicator, and he took the principles of freedom and communicated them directly with the people. Our national leaders today need to know how to utilize social media and go around, literally, we in the church need to learn, go around a biased, deceptive media. Worse than fake news, they're liars. They distort the truth, deny the truth, and promote lies. We literally need to take the truth to the people directly. And I'm praying our national leaders will learn the importance of that.
Amen. Sir, if you could just stay with us one more moment. I've got a question for you on the other side of the break. Thank you.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Friends, I have been looking forward to this week for many weeks now. My new book, Saving a Sick America, Prescription for Moral and Cultural Transformation, comes out in September. But we have now released the trailer for the book. There's a website we'll give you later in the week where you can go and download a free chapter from the book. It is a book that will vividly tell you where we are in America, but point for point through Scripture tell you God's prescription for change. And I'm greatly honored, from the heart, greatly honored that James Robison wrote the foreword for this book. I get requests constantly for forewords and endorsements and have to be so selective. It's got to be 10 times more for my colleague James Robison. So I'm truly honored that you wrote the foreword for the book and blessed that you're willing to stand with me as we talk about saving a sick America.
Well, I get asked scores of times every month to write forewords, and I basically cannot do it. But I wanted to do this because I do believe you're a voice for healing. I think you have a very prophetic voice, but I think you expose evil as a surgeon who's trying to show someone that they have a disease that is deadly and possibly terminal without the one hope, and there is a hope. And that medical doctor that prescribes the hope for the rightly diagnosed situation is the one most sought after, and rightly so. I think you recognize the illness, and I think you have the one and only perfect prescription. There is no perfect prescription for every illness we face in the physical realm, but there is one perfect. It's not wishful thinking. It's not feeble hope, but it's a real, solid, reliable, transforming promise. And so I really hope people will get it. I just thank God for you as a gift right now to the church. And so I think that if here's the thing people need to realize. Many times people think we got to start a new movement. No, we need to release the move of the Spirit on every movement. Many say, well, we need to start another organization or another party. No, we need to awaken the one organism that can impact every organization. And that organism is the body of Christ, the Church of Jesus Christ. That church needs to awaken. And when those people not only call by his name, but who know him as Father, have a personal relationship with him and with Jesus, that body of believers can transform this world. We have been left here on a kingdom's assignment to reveal the kingdom right now in the realm of darkness to those who are defeated by it and see them have their eyes open and come to the redemption that's freely offered. And experience kingdom reality right now in the midst of all the challenges and trials that we face. We can have peace in any valley. We can have provision as we face any attack and anything that the predator and the enemy brings against us. You are a blessing, and I am glad to encourage people to get the book and read it.
Well, again, thank you. I'm truly honored to have your forward and your endorsement and encouragement. And we share that heart of God's redemption through Jesus, through the Word, and it's going to come through us. Hey, I know your time is precious. I appreciate you being with us today. Thanks once more.
Well, go to the stream also and look at these different tributaries of wisdom and love. The stream is going to become more and more powerfully effective to give us insight so we not perish for lack of knowledge. And that knowledge means wisdom, the knowledge of the truth that does set us free and keep us free.
Amen. Amen. Stream.org, the place to go. God bless you, James.
Thank you so much, Doctor.
All right. Friends, stream.org for the latest articles. You can read my article on when the church celebrates same-sex surgery. And just tremendous articles that are there on a wide range of issues. Oh, yikes. I recommended this one last night. Teen Vogue is teaching your teenage girls, your teenagers, about sodomy. Yeah. Coaching them in sodomy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's up at the stream. Need to read it. Let me encourage you, if you want to get a signed and numbered copy of Saving a Sick America, it's a hardcover, about 250 pages, with a foreword by James Robison. It's due out in late September. We hope to have the pre-orders out earlier in the month, but the first ones we get, whether it's the first 100 or 300 or 500, it's based on reader interest. If you'd like to get a signed, numbered copy, so the first ones that come in from the first printing, we number them, 1 through 50 or 100 or 500, however many orders we get for the signed pre-ordered copy, and then I'll sign them to you. I actually do, actually sign them with Breaking a Stronghold of Food. Nancy signed them as well. So actually sign them. It's not a stamp signature. It's real, for whatever it's worth to you, if that's of value to you. And if your name is June, to June, and then here's a scripture for you, and then here's, you know, signed to you. And I don't mean a prophetic scripture for everybody. We look for a scripture that fits the book and put that in there. So it's kind of a collector's item from the very first printing. If you'd like to get that, go to my website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. You'll see it right on the homepage, one of the banners there on the homepage. Take advantage of that. Maybe get it as a gift for a friend or a loved one. Why not get a copy for your pastor? Get one for yourself and one for your pastor. We're getting some tremendous endorsements from some fine Christian leaders all over America. Dr. Robert Jeffress, pastor of First Baptist Church in Dallas, said, by accurately diagnosing just how sick America is, Dr. Michael Brown can now offer a hope-filled prescription for moral and cultural change based on the timeless principles of the Word of God. While some are throwing in the towel and calling on the church to retreat, Dr. Brown sees the current darkness as the church's great opportunity to arise and shine. America has fallen, but it can rise again. That is the message of the book. And Peter Sprigg with the Family Research Council said, Dr. Michael Brown's Saving a Sick America is unlike any other book I've read. I wish I could push a button and get it in the hands of every pastor in America. Oh, yeah, and there's a chapter, Restoring Thunder to Our Pulpits, calling on pastors and leaders to speak the truth without compromise, to speak the truth in love and the fullness of the Spirit, to thunder truth from the pulpits again that will awaken the church and thereby awaken the nation. Yes, and whatever the pulpit is, be it Twitter or Instagram or Facebook or YouTube or a physical pulpit, let thunder, holy, life-changing thunder, the reverence of the Lord return to our culture. I wish I could get a copy of this into the hands of every pastor in America. If it comes from you, if you're a congregant, even if it's a megachurch, you can get it to your pastor or pastoral team there. Get a copy for your pastor. Give it to him as a gift and say, hey, why don't you read this book? It's my gift to you. I believe they'll be engaged. And remember, it's filled with realism and filled with hope, Bible-based hope. Get a copy by going to AskDrBrown, askdrbrown.org.